I'm Mike, I'm an addict. I know hundreds of people in this fellowship and none of them are up. Right. Boy, I'll tell you, I've never spoke this early in the morning. I don't know if I can. Sure hard to beat a beautiful sunrise. You know, I came down here early and I was thinking, you know, to see all these addicts down here having coffee, awake, alert, you know, really enjoying life. And usually you read about us when a road grader runs over you, you know, out here because you passed out in the sand, you know. I've read about a number of them. It could have been me. And, but I'm very grateful. I left Purcellville, Virginia, if any of you all know where the mountain is out there. I live right below the mountain. And I had planned on coming down here for the weekend, but I have the responsibility of having two teenagers in full custody myself, and I'm responsible for them. And I was bringing my 14-year-old daughter and 17-year-old son down here, and my son, who has been incarcerated for about two out of his last three or four years, had gotten out and proceeded to steal some beer and get caught. And they got an ankle bracelet on him, so I had to stay there till midnight last night and then drive down. So I drove through the night coming around the Beltway. And I'll tell you, that's a wonderful time to come to Ocean City. It really is. There wasn't any traffic at all. It was great. Really enjoyed it. But the most important thing in my life is to stay clean. And I've been clean a while. If I make it two more days, I'll have 23 years and 3 months. So it works. I know this program works if we keep staying clean is the most important thing in our life, which it is to me. It's paramount. I've done just about everything clean. Let's say I committed every sin clean. And I paid the price, because we do. And but the one thing I haven't been locked up. You know, I really haven't been locked up since I've been clean. And that's really, really nice, because I don't like being locked up. And anyway, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I come from a really good family. My father was a professional baseball player, and he managed, coached up with Detroit Tigers for a number of years. And when I was little, we traveled. I went to over 25 grade schools before the sixth grade. He would go three or four places a year or more. And I lived in Panama, Puerto Rico, even in Cuba before Castro had taken over, because I'm an old man. You know, used to have a young man story around here, but now I got an old man story. And I remember having a big ego, great big ego. No addicts have big egos, right? And the first thing I can remember, I didn't want anyone to get anything over on me. And so I would do anything I could to keep him from getting anything over on me. And that's the way I remember. The other thing is I can remember, as soon as I could read, I would see government property, no trespassing. And that, it's just like a beacon to me, you know. I immediately had to trespass. I would see what was on the other side of that fence. And it just, I always remember before I ever used any kind of drugs that I just rebelled. I hated somebody telling me what to do, and I had a big ego. And the other thing I developed, when we traveled, I wasn't a very big guy. And incidentally, all these teeth I have aren't real, because I would fight big guys, you know. And so I don't have too many of these left. They're all fake. I have to go to the dentist a lot. And I'm paying for my sins, you know. Anyway, I can remember as we traveled around, there was always a bully. You guys, you know, whether you come from a big city or the country, it doesn't matter. There's always bullies around and people trying to push and shove you, and we react certain ways. You know, we hate that. And I can remember one day, I think I was 8 or 9 years old, I snapped and this big guy pushed me and I jumped up and I bit him on the nose, you know. Bit a big chunk out of his nose, too. I bit him hard. And you know what? He never picked on me again. And I learned something. I learned that if I struck back, I didn't have to be afraid of anybody. And that set up pretty much how I came up. You couldn't tell me nothing. I knew everything. I didn't take no shit off nobody, you know? And needless to say, in this society, when that happens, we end up in a lot of trouble later in life. I graduated from high school in 1962. I went to a Catholic high school, and I never really got involved in alcohol or drugs until my senior year and at my graduation party. And I still remember the first time I drank. I was 18 years old, and I remember the feeling today, what it gave me. I still remember the first time, and it made me feel so damn good. I can still remember saying, well, this is what I want to do the rest of my life. I want to feel like this. It took away all the fear inside of me that I had, and it made me feel good, and it set exactly what I wanted to do for the next 14 years, and I did. And I did it my way. It wasn't 2 months before I was in jail, you know. I mooned a cop, you know. I had a nickname for a long time because they put my name. I had my dad was fairly well known in town. My uncle was a congressman, and they put my name on the front page of a small town. And they called me Mooney for a long time, you know. And I left town for a long time. It was pretty embarrassing. And I'm glad his son got in trouble a little later on, you know. And anyway, I went away to college. I went to college for 5 years and never graduated. Because every place I'd go about 9 months or a year. And, you know, I've seen this in addicts, about 9 months or a year, and then pretty soon I had to go someplace else. I had all these problems. Always had a lot of problems. It was the same problems, but I didn't know. I couldn't look at myself and see myself. And, you know, I look at my children today, and God, if they aren't just like that, you know. They were lovely children until they got about 12 years old, and these aliens came down, and they inhabited them. And I'll tell you, life has not been fun since, you know. It's been a trip. I know the parole officers and the probation officers by first name basis. I hate to see the judge, you know. And I know all the police officers and the county officers because they all been to my house to pick them up sometime or another, bring them home or whatever. And I'll tell you the most amazing thing about this disease, and God, I really believe in my heart it's a disease, because knowing that they're facing long-time lockup, they'll go out and use immediately. And I have no power over them. I love my son. I love my daughter with all my heart. They mean more to me than anything in this life. And I have no control over them. All my experiences don't help them one bit. They tell you not to get involved in a relationship. They didn't tell me when I came in, but I did. And I spent 17 years with that woman, and I love her today. I loved her very much then. But we had 10 wonderful years of staying clean together and working this program, and she started using. And we had had children, and it grew apart, and she left 4 years ago. She left when these kids became difficult. She had all the fun when they were sweet and little, and she left, and it's been a very difficult time for me, you know, after I've been clean a long time. But, you know, we always keep our priority, and the priority for me is to stay clean. That's the most important thing in my life. And I've done that a number of ways. And but let me tell you a little more about my story. I went to jail almost immediately, and I had a number of trips, and I kept trying to switch things, and I dropped out of college. The Vietnam War was escalating, and most of my friends didn't want to go. I wanted to go. I joined up to be a Marine pilot and was accepted, and I ended up with a severe back injury, which they wouldn't accept me. Probably saved my life. I never did have much sense, and I would have probably charged up a hill and get shot. You know, it didn't bother me back then. I just, when I was using, I wasn't afraid of anything. I just really wasn't. Most of us aren't. And but somehow, I decided, since they wouldn't accept me, I've become a pilot. And I worked real hard at it, and I really believe that addicts, if we want to do something, you can't stop us. You can't stop us. We're compulsive, you know, obsessive. And I finally realized that you hear today about, you go in these mental health centers, they say obsessive compulsive disorder, 12-step program. Well, before I used, I was obsessive and compulsive, you know. And then I put my addiction on top of that, you know. So I have a lot of emotional, mental problems, no doubt about that. But I became a pilot at 23 years old. I managed an airport. I had a small fixed base operation, and again, like anything else, it didn't last long. I lasted about 2 years at that one, and moved on. Some things happened, and we all know why they happen. If we're clean for a while, we know why those things happen. And but I flew for a long time. I flew up until 2 years before I came into the program. And I like to tell this one story because it's so typical of us addicts. And what happened is I had a flight. I had my own airplane. Had a friend, and I got into construction, which is what I'd done all the summers of college. And I had a Cessna 180, and my boss was visiting, and he wanted me to fly him back to Columbus, Ohio. That's where I spent most of my life after I was out of college in Ohio. And I can remember thinking, well, I'm going to try not to get too screwed up tonight, and so I can fly early in the morning. It was an early morning flight, and it didn't work, of course, and I went out and I got really messed up. And we took off. And to this day, I swear to God, I don't remember, but I thought this other guy was flying. But he told me I was. And anyway, the only thing I remember is skidding down the runway, and the left wing came off. Then the right wing came off. And the prop, you've seen the movies where the prop kind of bends up and stops. And then the tail came off. Just the fuselage is going down the runway. And we come to a stop, and I can remember thinking, well, we're all okay, and you do everything that you're taught to do, you know, take the magneto switch, turn it off, and all that. We got out of the airplane, and I walked about 100 feet down. I looked back and thought, boy, flying's dangerous. I got to quit flying. It never occurred to me to quit, stop using, you know. It becomes such a part of my life, you know. And I've totaled cars, you know, I've wrecked cars. I sunk a boat one time. And we were going full speed in the fog. We were all messed up, and we hit rocks. These rocks on shore jumped out in front of us. And we ended up on shore, thrown on the rocks. And how we weren't killed, I don't know, or hurt bad, but we were just bruised a little bit. And I remember that wasn't my boat. That was my friend's father's boat. He wasn't a very happy man. We never got to use another one of his boats after that. But these are the stories that happen. And today, with two children that never know when they'll come home or what they're going to do, I remember these stories, and I hurt, man, because I know what can happen. I know what happens. You know, I know what my son likes to carry a knife, you know, or have a gun. You know, I know what happens. I know the danger of car accidents. My best friend was killed in a car accident. There's five of us that ran around together when we were 19 or 20, and his head went through a windshield, and he hit his. They hit our other best friend's head on, you know, around a dead man's curve, you know, all messed up. And that's what happens. So I know what can happen to them, and I pray, and my life has changed a lot. I came in, I got real angry at the world. I was real pissed off, and I blamed everybody else for my problems. I could never truly believe that it was anything to do with me. I had bad luck. God had picked on me, even though I was raised by wonderful parents, really, to this day. They were really good. I respect my father one heck of a lot. He's one good man. But he just learned a lot in the last 10 or 15 years, you know. Seems like he just suddenly, you know, suddenly I realized, you know, this guy's learned a lot. But he didn't know anything back when I was 19 or 20. He was dumber than heck. I really had this self-will that was almost like destructive. I didn't care. And I had all these feelings of fear that the only way I could stop them was by using, you know. And I think us addicts, that's what we do is we really, truly... Whether we're young or older and we get addicted, whether it's on pill or whether it's morphine or whatever it is, heroin, alcohol, combination of them, which it was for me, there's no one particular thing. I'd use anything because if I had a bad experience on one thing, I'd switch to something else. If I had a bad experience on it, I'd switch to something else. And then if I had a bad experience on that, I'd switch back to what I started on, you know. And to me, there's no such thing as a pure one kind of addict, you know, because I tried it all. And none of it really worked. It all ended up in the same spot. And I was one of these people that should really be locked up for life. I've done a lot of things I'm not at all proud of, and a lot of things. And, you know, a lot of us don't get caught for what we do. We get caught for little things, thank God. I'd be in the institution for the criminally insane, if not, you know, back in those days. But I had this mad passion to get rid of a lot of people, you know. I was real angry, and I was getting into making bombs, and because I knew that a gun couldn't take care of enough of them. And I was real angry. I was pissed off, and I was mad at everybody, you know. And I understand today. I know a lot of people don't understand how somebody can bomb. I understand. You're pissed off. You're angry. You don't give a crap about anybody but yourself. And we're self-centered people. And so I got into making bombs, but my mind wasn't working too well when I was about 30 years old. It was always kind of screwed up. And so rather than getting into electronics, I got into fuses using cherry bomb fuses. Great big bombs. And I started experimenting out in some farms in Ohio to see how big a bomb I could make. And I had a sizzler one day. And I lit it, and I was running away when it went off. And it blew me kind of, you know, picked me up and blew the seat of my pants out and threw me into the mud. And this friend I had was watching me. And I still remember he got up after I... started to get up, and I had mud and snow caked all over me. And I turned around, and I was red. It was all bare right here. And he started laughing. Are you all right? And you know, I realized that something was wrong with me. Started to realize something was wrong with me. I couldn't even make a bomb right, you know. And it scared me. And so I quit making bombs, but I ended up thinking, well, I'm going to end it. And I lived on this island in the middle of a lake up there. And in the beginning, I had this beautiful gal living with me. She was real nice. And she moved out, like everybody always did out of my life. You know, my parents had told me by this time, you know, Mike, we love you, but would you do us a favor? And I said, what? And they said, stay the hell 300 miles away. You're nothing but trouble. And so this gal moved out, and I thought, well, life isn't very good. I'm just going to drink and drug myself to death. And I lived out there, and I tried that. You know, and I'd come to and go out and come to. I don't know if anybody's ever gone that far, but I'll tell you, it was hell. It was living hell, and my mind was like crazy and buzzing, and I'd use and I'd come to, and that was the end of it for me. I finally didn't know what to do, and a lot of people had told me, my dad had told me when I was 19, son, there's something wrong with the way you drink, and my ex-wife had told me, there's something wrong with you, period. And everybody had told me there was something wrong with me, you know, that I used too much or something. And they used to say the nice thing, like, you drink too much. Because I hid a lot of my drug use. I didn't go around and let everybody know I was using drugs. And when I came into this program, I didn't like the word narcotics. It didn't sound very good. It's not like it is today. If you use narcotics, you were no good. You were no good. And so it was hard to say that. It was hard when I came into NA to say I was an addict. It really was. It was hard to accept it. I finally decided I had to do something about it, and I had this number somebody gave me, and they told me where to go. And there weren't many places for treatment centers back then. There weren't many. And there was a place called Riverside Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. And I remember going up there and saying, I think I might be an addict. I might need some help. And they said, well, do you have any insurance? And I said, well, no, I haven't had a job in a while. They said, well, do you have any money? I said, if I had money, I'd be using, wouldn't I? They said, well, we can't help you. And they gave me a couple phone numbers, and I went back and I called these people, and thank God they picked me up and took me to the meeting. And I haven't used since. And I was introduced to the 12 steps, which is how I live today. It's all I know. Everything I have, I owe this program. At the time, that first year, I can still remember. I don't even know how. I can hardly remember the first year, you know, except that I was really messed up. And everything I did was still what I used to do, except I didn't get caught. And it took me a while. And finally, this occurred to me that if I was going to stay clean in this program, that I had to do somebody else's will but my own. My mind don't think real well. My mind is real self-centered and always wants to do what's right for me. And it finally occurred to me that if I could accept I was powerless, and God, as I understood Him, was going to restore me to sanity, that I was going to have to do something else, or I was going to end up the same way. And so I made a decision. It was the greatest decision of my life. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God as I understood Him. And I did that. And I'll tell you, it was a big change in everything that happened to me and how I did and how I treated people from that day forward. And then I had to do some things. There was a lot of cleaning up to do. A lot of things inside of me that were wrong. And for the first time in my life, I could look in the mirror and see who caused every problem I had. And every problem that harmed other people was me. And I took a thorough fourth and fifth step as best I could. And, you know, we change as we have more clean time. I remember my first four-step, the best I could do it in my first year was I had this little pad about this big and a pencil, and I put down the things, you know, that I thought might be wrong with me. And I took my first fifth step that way, and what I learned to do is I can do that every year if I want to, you know. I think that we do have to constantly make spiritual progress. I really believe that. And I don't think we can do it without talking to another addict or another human being that can help us spiritually and guide us and be honest with us. And so I have to be able to do that. I have to take that fourth and fifth step. I didn't understand the sixth or seventh step. You know, people had told me I had certain character defects. You know, they kept telling... When people keep telling you the same things over and over again, you think you would listen. But I couldn't. I couldn't see them. And I had to work through them. I had to hurt. I had to do the thing, same thing over and over until I hurt so much inside. You know, we have a disease of the feelings. And I have to feel it. I have to touch it and feel it. And I had to hurt inside before I was willing to let these defects be removed. You know, I just couldn't do it by my mind. It just don't work that way. And so I did that, and I had some amends to make, you know, after I did that. And I it took me a long time to make amends. My ex-wife, my first ex-wife, it took me 17 years to make amends to her. I tried to make amends in the beginning. I remember in my first couple of years, I went and told her I was sorry for all the way I treated her. And she said, "Get the hell out of here. You know, I don't want to talk to you. You a-hole." You know? And I thought, well, I don't understand that. Here I'm trying to be nice and make up, you know? And it took me a long, long time staying clean to see what I really had done to her, you know, and get honest. And I went over there about 5-6 years ago and almost 18 years clean, and I truly made amends to her. We cried and held each other and became friends. And it was very difficult because I had two children by her and alienated. I couldn't be trusted with them when I was using them when they were little. But I ended up, when the one gal turned 13, she sent her over to me. These ex-wives leave these teenagers with me. I don't think they like me. No. Anyway, I had to put her through a treatment center, which I did 13 years ago. And somehow she went through a really hard time, but she's come out of it, and she's doing pretty well. And she's married. She's 29 years old and beautiful. And she's doing quite well in life. Anyway, I think what I came to realize is after being clean for a while is that rather than let things accumulate and have all these problems, which seemed to follow me wherever I went after I was clean too, you know, because I came over to this area of the country, left Ohio, 8 years clean, and I've been over here 15 years in Northern Virginia. And I had the same problems over here I had back there when I left. I couldn't understand that. But I know today that if I want to change anything, I sure can't change anything in my children. I can't change anything in my relationships. The only thing I can change is me. And so I try to work the 10th step by looking at myself each day. I do not want to go to bed angry at night. I do not. It just eats at me. It tears me up. It really screws my serenity and peace of mind up, which is what I want today. You know, a lot of my priorities have changed. When I first got clean, I wanted to be successful. I wanted to have a lot of material things. And I had them. And I wasn't happy inside. I didn't feel that much better. I've lost them, you know, and I've had them again. And they're really not important. What's important is what's inside of me. What's important is this program for Narcotics Anonymous in our lives and the 12 steps and how they can change us. So I try to take that inventory and I try to get closer to God through meditation. I've tried a lot of different ways. This is a wonderful program because it's not a religious program, and we've got to let go of that. It's a spiritual program, and we accept anybody. And this is the greatest program on earth. I really truly believe it, because there's nobody that wants to belong in this program that's not welcome. That's the truth. We're usually, I really say, everybody in NA are the people that are too sick to be anyplace else in life. Then you're just right for Narcotics Anonymous, you know. And somehow, this loving God, as I understand him, and I didn't believe in God when I came in. I used the Great Spirit for many years, because I'm part Indian. And I used the Great Spirit, and today I believe in God. It's all one and the same. I respect other people's beliefs. I found out through this 11th step that I also read other literature. Some's been around for a couple thousand years. I use whatever I can and I apply it. And when it's ready to put in my life, I put it into my life. Because I truly, truly believe that if we don't progress and move forward spiritually, that we become stale and we might use again. And my greatest fear is that someday I wake up and I forget I'm an addict. That's my greatest fear. And then I die all screwed up, and somebody said, I told you you'd die that way. You know, I really don't want to. I want to stay clean. I want to go clean. And the 12th step, I think, is probably, to me today, the most important step, because it's practicing these principles, these 12 steps, in all my affairs. And that's difficult in this world. It really is, because you don't read on the front page of the newspaper about these politicians practicing the 12 steps. You ever hear on them say, I'm powerless, or I'm insane, or I've turned it over to God today? They don't. The world doesn't work that way. But we have to. I have to. I can't operate the same way I used to. And so I really believe that. One thing I learned from my sponsor early on was to be involved in a group. And the group I belong to today, I like to go in, I like to make coffee, I like to get it ready. And you know, I look forward all week to that group, and I look forward to being there and being part of it. And it's the most important thing in my life is to stay clean and to be part of it. And it's not a lot of 12-step work, but it's the basic for me, because I get to see new people come in and I'm there and I get a chance to see them and be with them and give a little bit back to what this program's given me, just a little bit. But I've done that since I've been clean. I've always had a home group, and it's real easy for me to get my mind and listen to my mind and get away and forget that I have to stay very fresh in this program that I only have today. And when I'm involved in a home group, that keeps me real. We call the home group the bottom of the mountain, right there in Round Hill. And if anybody's out there on Tuesday nights at 8:30 in Round Hill, now Round Hill's a big town. There's three churches in it, one main road. It's a church in the middle, okay? The White Baptist Church in the middle. At 8:30 on Tuesday nights, and I always plug my home group. I think it's very important. But another thing I did when I first came in is my sponsor just seemed to know what I needed more than I knew, and he kind of guided me in a lot of things. And he got me involved in service work early, and he had me running penitentiary meetings. And I went in and ran the Ohio State Penitentiary meeting for 7 years, and Chillicothe Penitentiary meeting. And I never realized I was a real sick person. You know, when I first came in, I didn't think there was too much wrong with me. I just used too much. That was my problem. I just used too much. I remember having about 3 or 4 years clean, and I told my story, and I've cleaned it up a lot. And I told my story at this Ohio State Penitentiary, these hardened criminals, right? And this one guy got up and said, "God, you're sick." And that insulted me. I went home, I looked at it, and you know, if it wasn't for the grace of God, I'm real sick. You know, He's blessed me, and He's blessed you all. You know, when you're here and you're clean, and you look around and the sun's rising, and you know, last night I saw the sunset on the Shenandoah River. I was on top of the Blue Ridge Mountain. I kayak. I love to kayak. I was down on the river and I came off about sunset, and I came over and pulled over and I overlooked it and watched the sunset over the mountains. This morning I'm here to watch the sunrise on the ocean. Man, that's an amazing thing. I remember it all. It's amazing. And I think I'd probably have talked long enough. They say you're supposed to make the meeting last the full time, but I think I've said everything I have to say. I can't give enough thanks for what I found. And I will tell anybody new, and I'm glad to see you're at the conventions, man. These are very, very nice. I can remember when we didn't have any. And one thing I remember when I came in is I was in hell. I was really, really hurting. And somebody told me that if you work these 12 steps, this program may not open up the gates of heaven and let you in, but it'll open up the gates of hell and let you out. And I've never forgot that, because it opened up the gates of hell and let me out. And it's also gave me a lot of peace and serenity and a wonderful way to live. And with that, I thank you. Have a wonderful day.